everyone is talking around GHF and about GHF. Joining me is Reverend Johnny Moore, chair of the Humanitarian Aid Organization, garnering kudos and critiques. Johnny, you have a rich background, having studied the Middle East and understand the complexities. Did you ever expect this position to come with bonuses, including defamation and blood libels?
You know, I would say, having spent most of my adult life wandering around the Middle East, and I'm used to lots of conspiracy theories and lots of cynicism, but I did not anticipate the level of insanity that I've experienced the last few weeks. Not because we haven't seen all of this before, but we sort of knew that GHF would be something that Hamas wouldn't like. That's not why we did it, but we knew Hamas, because they controlled humanitarian aid and they made billions of dollars off of it over years, like they would feel somehow threatened by what we were doing. We knew that some aspects of the UN community that are sort of known to be anti-American and anti-Israel, you know, would be against us. But I had no idea, and I did not anticipate, that we would be kicking a hornet's nest that included basically the very, very top of the United Nations, leaders of many of these revered humanitarian organizations that have really kind of overreacted to our work. And for whatever reason, I don't quite understand it, when we want to work with them and they want to shut down, they have decided that they feel just fine using talking points and information they get from Hamas. And so, yeah, I knew this would not be an easy task. There's nothing harder than doing anything in Gaza. But I did not expect the level of intentional vitriolic lying, you know, that we've experienced.
Can we delve into that further? Because I think it's important for people to understand there's so much misinformation that's rampant. And if you can give one or two examples to try to explain the misinformation.
There are a lot of examples. So the first one is that GHF, you know, is meant to try to move Gazans, right? So, you know, this is an attempt to move Gazans, and we want to get them all in the south, and that's why we're distributing aid in the south. And in actuality, you know, our plan from the very beginning was to distribute aid across all of the Gaza Strip. We have plans to open up sites, both serving more in the center of the Gaza Strip and the north of the Gaza Strip. That's been a plan from the very beginning. It's still the plan, you know, if we can get permission and the resources to do it. You know, another of the lies is that there have been daily massacres at our sites. You know, there hasn't been a single massacre at our sites. In fact, there's been no violence at all at our sites, or within our sites, except for when Hamas threw two grenades at our American aid workers about 10 days ago, and trying to provoke our guys to, in order to get the assailants to try to create a massacre at one of our sites to sort of contribute to their information war ahead of the ceasefire negotiations. We can't control what happens out of our sites. It's a deadly, deadly place in the Gaza Strip. There have been civilian casualties. You know, the IDF is direct about that, and they do investigations. They've said themselves there have been civilian casualties that they've been responsible for, but it's been unintentional, and the numbers quite much smaller. You know, we don't want a single person to die. Like, we're there so people live. But what the press doesn't report at all is the fact that Hamas has killed and injured hundreds, if not thousands, of people. And then they try to attribute those deaths to GHF, or even on days we weren't even operating at all, you know, many, 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 many miles away from where we are operating, or they try to attribute those deaths to the IDF, you know, to try to shut us down. You know, I'll give one more. I mean, there are a bunch of them, but the latest one, you know, that came from UNRWA and 138 organizations is that GHF is replacing 400 small distribution sites with four large distribution sites that people can't get to. And of course, you know, our model is different. There was food insecurity in Gaza. We needed to surge massive amounts of aid to as many people as we can reach. Three of our sites are in pretty reasonable proximity to about 800,000 Gazans in the southern part of the part of the strip. But it's just disingenuous to say that the alternative are 400 UN distribution sites. Like that number itself is a number that preceded the October 7th terrorist attack. That it hasn't been that way for a long time. That infrastructure doesn't even exist anymore, you know, in the Gaza Strip, aside from the fact that the infrastructure was flawed in so many ways because of Hamas's ability to manipulate, to control, and to use it for their advantages. But you know, these are some, you know, there are a lot more of them, and you know, the crazy thing is, though, is as hard as we try to tell the truth, it just seems like people and many in the media, in the international community, even some politicians, aren't interested in knowing the truth. They're just too married to an old broken system that has only caused more suffering to the people of Gaza.
You know, for the person listening to this, if you take us through the process of what's really happening, I think it would help a lot. Most people don't understand sort of the division right now in terms of the IDF in Gaza, how food is distributed, the mechanism, who has to approve it. I think it would help clarify some what happens on a day-to-day basis.
GHF, which was an idea, by the way, that preceded the Trump administration, it actually was an idea that originated in the Biden administration that was implemented as very often is the case, you know, with President Trump. It takes sort of the implementation of an unconventional idea, you know, to solve a problem. On May 5th, ahead of the president's visit to the Gulf, at the White House, President Trump said to the press that he was angry that Hamas was stealing the food from the people of Gaza, and the United States was going to do something about it. And so GHF is the doing something about it. Now, when the president was saying that Hamas was stealing food from the people of Gaza, here's what that means. It means that for many, many years, either by violence or by threats of violence, or sometimes voluntarily because of you know, the situation in Gaza, basically every piece of food that went into the Gaza Strip was under the control of Hamas. And so what Hamas would do is they would allow it to come in, but they would tax it. They would put it to centralized warehouses, which would then be distributed to their preferred partners. They would take a percentage of the aid to begin with and give it to their people of Hamas. That was about 25% at a certain point. They would take some of the aid that was given for free by the world, and then they would go sell it to make money off of it. And so Hamas used aid to control the people of Gaza, and they commoditized aid to make billions and billions of dollars. And this continued during this war. So in the heart of this war, at a certain point, Hamas was moving fighters between different parts of the Gaza Strip by putting them on aid trucks. Hamas was transferring information, transferring messages from its allies or fighters in different parts of the Gaza Strip via aid trucks. And we've all seen the videos, of course, of UN or World Food Program or UNICEF aid trucks that as they arrive into the Gaza Strip, you know, in the middle of this war, you know, the IDF is the professional military operating in the Gaza Strip. They control the borders of the Gaza Strip. There's an organization called COGOT, which is responsible for a lot of this and has been for many, many years. And what happens almost every time is you'll have a convoy of UN trucks, say 50 trucks, going into the Gaza Strip. Almost as quickly as those trucks get into the Gaza Strip, the trucks are hijacked by armed militants, either Hamas directly or affiliates of Hamas, and then Hamas steals the aid. Okay, so GHF was created to solve the problem of the mass diversion of aid. So Hamas couldn't use aid to prolong the war, to further repress and oppress the people of Gaza, to make money, you know, all of these different things. So the one problem that GHF was created to solve was this problem, the mass diversion of aid. So what GHF did was set up an initial 4 secure distribution sites. That's what they're called. So these are places of the mass distribution of aid. So far, you know, in about 6 weeks, we have distributed 75 million meals of food, 75 million meals of food through these 4 secure distribution sites. There's been no mass diversion of any aid whatsoever, not a single truck stolen. The operation works on the ground with a combination of very, very experienced American contractors, some of them with more than 30 years in the aid community, some of them of many of the most decorated American veterans, been in very, very complex environments around the world. That 75 million meals worth of food is like a million and a half boxes of food, basically.
That's a tremendous number. I don't think people really can quite grasp that.
No, it's unbelievable. And every box has a higher caloric count than the UN standard. It has a balanced diet. You know, most of the time, the aid coming into the Gaza Strip, for instance, if you see a World Food Program truck go in, it almost always is a truck. And the only thing on the truck is flour. When they come to our secure distribution site, they get flour, they get lentils and beans, they get salt, they get everything that they need for a family of 5 for 3.5 meals in a box.
For how long?
A box is about 3.5 days of food for a family of 5.
What happens after that? Because obviously the sustainability of this is huge. It's enormous.
First of all, we don't require the Gazans to take a box, right? So they can bring a canvas bag, and if they need more oil or need more flour or beans or something, you know, for hummus, you know, they can take what they need. Or let's say, you know, there's an elderly person or women, you know, that can't get to our distribution sites very easily. Well, you know, a 25-year-old Palestinian from you know, Gazan will take a canvas bag and collect food for various families and take it back to them. So that's the model. It's surging massive amounts of food into the Gaza Strip to meet the food insecurity need in ways that Hamas can't steal it. And that's not just what we do. So we've been distributing aid more recently in partnership with a series of local Gazan NGOs to actually take boxes into the central Gazan Strip to people in need through this local NGO. And in the immediate pilot, in the first 2 days, we distributed over 2,000 boxes.
It's interesting you bring that up, you know, because we have someone in Gaza that reports for us, and there are Gazans that have said that they're afraid to go south. It takes a long time to get there, and they're afraid of being shot, whether it's by Hamas, you know, they claim it could be the IDF. We're hearing different things like this. You know, how do you respond to that?
We also don't want people to have to go to the south. I mean, we want to have more distribution sites in the center and in the north. And that was part of the plan and still part of the plan. You know, part of our challenge is there has been this like very, very intentional global disinformation campaign that originated with Hamas and was shared around the world through Hamas-affiliated media. And what I mean by Hamas-affiliated media, I'm not just talking about, you know, Hamas's communications division. I'm talking about sympathetic people in the Associated Press and Reuters and BBC all around the world whose sources are Hamas. And part of one of the reasons why we haven't been able to expand more into the north is because this disinformation campaign has spread all these lies about our, you know, sites being subject to daily massacres at our sites, which is just not true. What is true for sure is there have been civilian casualties in the Gaza Strip. That is true. You know, it's a deadly, deadly place. It's a very, very small, confined place. You know, we've been operating in two wars, you know, not just the the hot war between Israel and Hamas, but we also operated every day during the 12-day war between Israel and Iran. So everything about the Gaza Strip is deadly. So we understand, you know, that people are concerned for their safety to get to our distribution sites.
So what happens with those people in the north, because they are saying they're not getting food? What can be done?
Well, there are a few things about that. The first thing is the Israelis have not stopped food going into the north. Okay, so there's this lie out there that, you know, there was no baby formula, and then there was no food, and then there was no, you know, all this stuff. Now there are things that we disagree with, you know, Israel about all of this when it comes to water, and and we can't operate in the north until, you know, they give us permission to do so, and all of these things. But one of the big lies is that there's no food in the north. There's a lot of food in the north. It comes in almost every day. Trucks get in there almost every day. It's just that the food is controlled by Hamas. That's number one. Number two, you know, in the meantime, like, we have to take care of the people that we can take care of. And as difficult a situation as it is, we have already served about 800,000 of the people of Gaza. And that's kind of the minimal estimate. It could be that we've touched closer to 1 million, you know, so there, you know, the different estimates as to how many people are in the Gaza Strip, but normally, you know, the round number is normally about 2 million. It's probably a bit less than that, but we've already touched about half of those people just through our secure distribution site. So one of the reasons why we're sort of like, you know, daily out there saying, you know, we have to be able to open more sites, we have to get closer to the need and all of these things, is because we want to touch more people. In the meantime, we just touch as many people as we can, you know, practically speaking.
How many people and who are they that are volunteering to help bring the food in? Are they military people? You know, a lot of things have been out about this too. I mean, who are these people?
Yeah, these are amazing people. First of all, the person on the ground that runs the humanitarian operation, who's been in Israel every day from the beginning of this, is a guy named John Acri, who spent 30 years of his career in the aid community, and his deputy also spent about that amount of time. So you have, you know, what this is another one of the lies about us, like that we don't, as an organization, we don't know what we're doing. We know very well what we're doing, and we have an incredibly, incredibly experienced team. The folks who designed the actual SDSs, you know, and provide security to the convoys as they are entering, are mainly U.S. Special Forces retired veterans. So they're veterans. You know, these are people that served in Afghanistan. They've served in complex humanitarian environments and other places. You know, there are people on the ground there that have been responsible for some of the most sophisticated U.S. logistical operations in recent memory. It's an incredible team, and the team is very, very dedicated. I mean, the fact that they continued on while the Iranian missiles were, you know, being fired, the fact that, you know, our couple of guys that got hit by a grenade, you know, two grenades, Iranian, by the way, grenades that were in the Gaza Strip. These guys were like just ready to get back to serve people, and everyone else on the team showed up the next day to continue serving these people. So these people should not be derided. I mean, these are incredibly, incredibly experienced people. They're heroes, and yet, you know, they're treated as, like, you know, they're called mercenaries by Hamas and by the press and like all of this stuff. And it's just crazy. You know, another one of the lies, Felice, is that the UN says that we don't abide by humanitarian principles, right? And there are four of them. It's like humanity, impartiality, neutrality, and independence, right? So these are like the four principles. And the one that they say we really don't do, I mean, the independence one, they don't, you know, it's because everyone seems inflicted with some form of anti-Semitism, and they think, you know, the Jewish community controls the whole world, apparently, that we cannot as Americans act independent. You know, that's just bigotry. Like, that's nonsense. They don't, you know, sometimes that pops up, but putting that aside, the one that they really say that we're guilty of is that we're not neutral. But the definition of neutrality is that you deliver aid in a way that doesn't aid a party to the conflict. That's the definition of neutrality. So who with a straight face could say that UNRWA was a neutral organization? Or who with a straight face can say that if every single truck that the UN sends into the Gaza Strip is immediately taken over by terrorists with guns, and they knowingly do it every single day, that somehow the UN is acting neutrally, with neutrality? I mean, the difference is that our security professionals on the ground are people with the best in the world, with enormous experience, that have basically never been in an environment that they haven't already experienced before in some way. I mean, these are the people that we're working with. You know, the people the UN are working with are terrorists that are designated terrorists in the United States and Europe, you know, and in the UK. I mean, the whole thing is just, it's just all disingenuous. I think the reason why the UN, and hopefully this changes, because, as I keep saying, I say it every day, like, we can work out our differences with the international system later on. Right now we have an emergency, and we want to work with the UN and the World Food Program and UNICEF and all these organizations, because we just can't do it alone. We have to help these people.
Right.
But but they're boycotting us. I mean, they're boycotting us, and they never boycotted Hamas.
I was going to ask you, where is the UN and the EU? And you really kind of just, you know, you answered it. But I want to go back to the numbers of people on the ground. I mean, are we talking about hundreds? Are we talking
It depends on how you count the whole team, but it's fewer than 300 people in the whole entire operation that are operating this. And so that's the other thing. If you're a government, you know, if you're the European Union or the United States, like, this whole operation, as complex and difficult and expensive as it is to provide millions of meals of food, you know, per day, about between 1 and 3 million meals we distribute every day, it's actually far cheaper than any of the comparative UN organizations.
I'm speaking with Reverend Johnny Moore, who chairs the GHF, which is the main humanitarian aid organization that is delivering food into Gaza these days. Are there other aid organizations, and, you know, there seem to be, that are working, some smaller organizations as well? Have they reached out to you? Are you aware of what else is happening in the Strip?
Yes. So there are some smaller, lesser known organizations that we've been able to meaningfully collaborate with. There have been people in the UN system that have reached out to us and basically expressed their outrage at their leadership for the way they're not cooperating with us. We have had some meetings with some leaders of large humanitarian organizations that we will continue to meet with if they'll continue to meet with us. But it seemed to us that some of these meetings were not sincere. You know, they were meetings mainly meant to try to reduce the criticism, you know, that we were sending their way, because they and I should say, like, it wasn't our intention to pick a fight with the international aid community. They're the ones that were calling for us to be dismantled and spreading all this disinformation. We had to defend ourselves just to continue operating. But so far, I mean, I asked for a meeting with the UN Secretary General about a month ago. I finally, maybe 3 weeks ago, I finally got a reply last week from his office. He never replied to my letter at all. You know, the letter says, asked him if he would please issue a statement condemning Hamas for killing 12 of our local Gazan aid workers. He never replied to my letter, but I got an email from his office saying the Secretary General was too busy to meet, but he would suggest that I meet with the head of OSHA, the humanitarian division of the UN. I've been trying now for a few days to get that meeting set. They've offered a meeting related to dialogue. I told them that's not enough. It has to be dialogue plus, because we are not going to play this game to have a photo op around the table to take pressure off of you, because, you know, you're some uncomfortable truths about how you've managed the money of the United States and the Europeans and others and allowed aid to be stolen by terrorist organizations. you know, is you know, we're not here for photo ops. We're happy to dialogue, but it has to be dialogue plus. You know, we need to be immediately collaborating on something. We need to be doing stuff together because the people of Gaza need to be fed. And that's what I keep telling people. The irony of this whole thing is we only have one mission, just one mission, which is to get as much food to the Gaza Strip as possible.
This comes with a huge budget, and the State Department just approved $30 million, but that's not going to cover it. What is needed, and where's it going to come from?
I mean, we're hoping that the U.S., which has been, you know, very involved from the beginning of this idea till now. I mean, their public involvement is now becoming well known, but we're hoping the U.S. does more. We're hoping that European countries help meaningfully. We're hoping that Arab states, who care sincerely about the Palestinians and should be as enraged as the United States is about the way that some of these international organizations have given their money to terrorists, that we're hoping they'll all come on board. But it's an expensive operation. I mean, in order for us to do what needs to be done in the Gaza Strip, I mean, it's going to take a minimum of $150 million a month to fully implement, you know, the plan, and it's got to grow from there if we're really going to help everyone. And so it's a nation state type of project. You know, I met with one, I met with the Germans, for instance, in Brussels, about 10 days ago. And I was shocked when I learned that in Germany, the official policy, I learned from the Germans and from the EU, actually, the official policy both of Germany and of the EU is still to work with UNRWA. And it's just insane. I mean, you know, if everyone knows that UNRWA is not a neutral organization, everyone knows that UNRWA had employees that were holding hostages, everyone knows that UNRWA facilities, you know, we're housing Hamas equipment. Everyone knows that UNRWA schools had curriculum that the whole world could read that was promoting hate. And a lot of people seem to think, and I can't verify it, that as many as 50%, 49, 48%, I've seen different numbers, of UNRWA employees were somehow linked meaningfully to Hamas. I mean, for a country like Germany, with its precision and attention to detail, to give its taxpayer money to an organization that you know is about as close to materially sponsoring terror as any large humanitarian organization, is just incomprehensible to me. And the fact that this is the policy of the EU and everything else, you know, and even if you don't see UNRWA the way I see UNRWA, the fact is, you know, and the nicest way of looking at the problem is that UNRWA is just failed. The fact that we had this war, the fact that all of this took place, the fact that there is no peace there is an indication that UNRWA failed. And so it is incomprehensible to me.
So to that end, what does a ceasefire look like? You know, Hamas doesn't want your organization there. They'd like to see the UN back in.
Yeah, I mean, Hamas, we understand that at certain phases of the ceasefire negotiations that one of the Hamas demands was that GHF be dismantled, which I think kind of tells you all you need to know. You know, when Hamas is against you, you're probably on the right side. And hopefully, hopefully GHF will survive the ceasefire negotiations. But we don't choose whether we get to operate in the Gaza Strip. Other people make that decision for us. But if we have the privilege of doing it, despite all the complexity and despite all the lies and despite all the threats on everybody's lives and despite the huge sacrifice of our local Gazans who were killed and injured, like, we will press on and we will do more if we can do it. And we don't have to just do food. We can do more. We can do healthcare. We can help with education and putting roofs over the heads of people. Like, we want to serve these people. We want to be there for the long haul.
Too many media outlets are showing photos of starving people and children. Is this an accurate portrayal?
I mean, every single day we're seeing something that no one has seen in the Gaza Strip in a long time. At our sites, every single day, we meet people who are smiling for the first time in a long time, and we're talking to them. And I think if we weren't on the ground and we weren't interacting with them in the way we are, maybe we would also be susceptible, you know, to some of the disinformation. That's not to say that there isn't profound suffering in the Gaza Strip. It's as bad as anywhere in the world. But the people that we are helping are actually being helped. And I think we're showing the world that this was a false choice that the aid community was making, that the cost of doing business meant that 10, 20, sometimes 75, 80% of your aid had to be stolen by a terrorist organization, and it had to prolong the war and all of these things. Like, you know, that's, I mean, we're getting to know the Gazans, and there are many of them who, for the first time, because Hamas doesn't control their food anymore, they also feel free to say what they really think, because food in the Gaza Strip doesn't just mean survival. It means freedom.
Have you been to the Gaza Strip yourself?
Yeah, I was there. Of course, I'm volunteering to help GHF, but as quickly as I agreed to help, I went over, I went on the ground, I visited with our team, I was in the operations center, I interacted with everyone. And by the way, it happened to be the day after I made an unusual trip. I went from Damascus, Syria on one day with my dear friend and mentor, Rabbi Cooper. And the next day I was in Jerusalem and then down at Gaza. And so very, very much inspired by these incredible, incredible people down there that are showing up every single day to try to help as many people as
how dangerous is it? Because I think again that the world isn't understanding, you know, how difficult a situation it is in Gaza. You are very lucky that no one has been wounded seriously.
Yeah, no, it's the most. There's no more deadly place on the planet than the Gaza Strip. It's just as deadly as it gets. And to make it worse, Hamas has issued direct threats on both the Gazans and the Americans, which I think they realized very quickly was a mistake. This is you don't threaten Americans with someone like Donald Trump sitting in the White House. But yeah, I mean it's very dangerous. And you know, our local team members, as I said, I mean they paid the ultimate price. And for the people of Gaza themselves, this is a war zone. You know, we didn't wait to a ceasefire to start feeding people. They couldn't wait. They needed food now. And yeah, it's very, very, very deadly.
Well, Reverend Moore, that's a very difficult thing that you're involved in. And I'm sure a lot of people are really, I think, concerned. And you've helped to really understand what's really happening on the ground. I can't leave you yet. I think it's important to discuss your meeting with President al-Shaarawy. Your other hat is very much about the Middle East and to understand the complexities and also towards normalization with some of these countries in the Abraham Accords, which is not an easy task. So if you can shed a little bit of light on that visit, it would be wonderful.
Yeah, I'll without disclosing too much of the conversation, Rabbi Cooper has talked to plenty of people about our visit, so without repeating
including the media line, he has.
I think one of the first places he spoke, as always. But I would say I thought that the really, really hard thing to do was going to be work on the Syria challenge, and that it would be a bit easier to just wake up every day and provide food to people in Gaza. And I found the exact opposite to be true. I found Syria to be, as complex as it is, an easier challenge, and Gaza to be much more difficult. The best thing I could say about I guess the most helpful thing I could say about the visit with Shara is the fact that the visit took place at all, I think is a very positive thing. I would say that Shara is the leader he reminded me the most of in the region was MBS. And he reminded me of MBS for two reasons. The first reason is he's very forward-looking. Unlike so many leaders in the Middle East, that every conversation is about the past. They never leave the past. You're always talking about the past. And Shara talks about the future. And I thought that was, first of all, it was a surprise to me. And secondly, it was an encouragement to me. I know how to work to achieve things in the future. I can't get in a time machine and fix the problems of the past. The second thing, and the second characteristic that he shares with MBS, is that he's quite pragmatic. He's a very pragmatic type of leader. He has problems he needs to solve. He looks at challenges through, you know, through problem solving. And we always do better with pragmatic counterparts who appreciate the United States of America as a partner. And so I was encouraged by the visit. He is, you know, he is absolutely comes from a Islamist, you know, type of background. I would say he is an Islamist, though I also even hesitate using the term because there are lots of different types of Islamist, but I have never met someone of his community like him. I was surprised. And of course, I was one of the biggest critics at the very beginning of all of this. I still remain unbelievably skeptical. I think we should temper our expectations. The number one thing that has to happen in Syria is Syria needs to get stable and secure and get a basic economy and all of these things that'll lift all ships. And that's the priority of the United States, has to be his priority. And I do appreciate that some of the rhetoric coming from Israel has, despite various challenges, and there have been a bunch of them, the rhetoric coming from Israel has become more hopeful that one day we might have something that was once inconceivable, that Syria and Israel could be at peace.
Reverend Johnny Moore, really frank conversation. Thank you for your time, and a pleasure. And I hope it goes a little easier on the streets of Gaza.
Thank you for having me, Felice.